It's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year?
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations? Forgotten. The history?
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hello and welcome to the Wisden Cricket Weekly podcast. England lose a test and they lose it in style, lasting just a fraction more than 80 overs across the two innings as South Africa's all-star attack ran riot at Lord's. We'll talk about that test, the 100, a bit of bilateral white ball cricket. And for the first time on the show, hear directly from Ben Stokes himself, who spoke to Joe earlier in the week in the run-up to the release of Ben Stokes' Phoenix from the Ashes, which comes out on Amazon later this week. I'm Yaz Rana, and with me today is the magazine editor of Wisden Cricket Monthly, Joe Harmon, and the editor-in-chief of Wisden Cricket Monthly, Phil Walker. But first, let's go to Mark Butcher to hear his thoughts on South Africa's win at Lord's. A heavy defeat for England at Lord's, the first loss of the Stokes-McCullum era. England were blown away with the bat. South Africa were brilliant with the ball, England not very good with the bat. Which of those two do you think was most significant in determining the result?
In a vacuum, you'd say it was South Africans bowling. But as much as it's beguiling and enticing to sort of to draw a line under everything that has gone before and start solely with the Stokes-McCullum era, of course, those sorts of batting performances, whether it's 82.4 overs, I think they managed across the two innings, were not quite the norm, then they were extremely regular or far too regular under the previous regime. So, in isolation, it's South Africa's bowling. In terms of a sort of like the holistic view of English Test match batting stretching over a few years, then it's kind of something that you could see coming. I happened to whisper to Ian Ward on the Friday morning just before we went on air that I had a funny feeling it might be all done, before the end of Friday, and it turned out that it wasn't a bad shout. We know that there was going to be. We've always known that playing in the way that they want to play is going to throw up occasions where this happened. Although I would argue actually that they didn't really kind of go out and try and blitz the ball all over the place. Neither in the first or the third innings of the match, which kind of throws up a rather more interesting or rather more subtle diagnosis, which is that given conditions where it's absolutely imperative that you're able to show sort of decent defensive qualities and bat for a bit of time, we're no better at it now than we were before.
Just on South Africa, this test match is being played with the backdrop of the new future tour programme. The next 4 years, South Africa are solely playing two test series. For them to put a performance in like that at the start of a series with not that much cricket behind them, and then particularly that bowling attack, according to Quick Viz, that's the fastest ever bowling attack across a test match in England since those kind of records existed. It was a stunning performance, and in Marco Jansen they have this new superstar who batting at six bowls from 6 for 8 and was totally brilliant. And then Kagiso Rabada, I think he's got the lowest strike rate of any test match bowler who's got 250 test match wickets. It's a really, really impressive attack.
Yeah, it is. I think Arthur's had the stats in his pocket before the first ball was bowled the test match that he has the lowest strike rate of anybody since the beginning of the 1900s, which is absolutely incredible. he's just a wonderful bowler. He's so good to watch bowl. I mean, you know, you're almost surprised every time the ball comes out as quickly as it does, because it's just so smooth. You know, it must be like watching. I never had the pleasure of watching Mikey bowl live. But you know, it has that similar sort of feel to it, whereby, you know, it's just poetic on the way to the crease. Even when he hits the crease, it doesn't feel like it should be taking a great deal out of him, and this thing just comes fizzing out of the hand. Warning, kids, it does hurt. Fast bowling, very bad for the body. so don't think that if Rabada suddenly drops 5, 6, 7 miles per hour in pace, it's because he's not trying. It's just because he makes it look easy, but it clearly isn't. So look, Norkia, we knew, we saw, he served notice of that when he made his debut against England back in 1920, that here was a bloke who just could tear in all day and bowl eye-wateringly quickly. So I'm not sure, you know, running up and bumping the crap out of him again. I mean, they did it at Centurion back in the first test match of that series. And he stood up to it, no problem, and then came out and bowled the speed of light afterwards. It does seem as though there's a few elephants' memories knocking around, if not in the management, then at least from the guys on the field. So, I mean, they're very, very good. And the thing that makes them really, really potent is a batting lineup that kind of that looks, in terms of the way they played anyway in this test match, that has the sort of basic tenets of being able to score as many runs as you need in the conditions that you're given. And after all, that's really all batting's about. Can you score enough runs to give your bowling attack a chance to win your test matches? And they did that superbly at Lords. I mean, you know, I don't think anybody realistically thought at the beginning of the game that 360 or whatever it was going to be enough to win the test outright. But it proved it was plenty.
On Sky commentary, you didn't hold back in your assessment of whether you think Zach Crawley should be in the side for the second test or not. Since then, Brendan McCullum has come out in support of Crawley, and there's one line that caught the eye. I look at a guy like Zach, and his skill set is not to be a consistent cricketer. What does that mean? Because if you're averaging in the 20s normally before McCullum reinvented test cricket, you occasionally still score 50s when you average 20. That's kind of how it works. That's how averages work.
Or even hundreds, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So what is McCullum saying? Is he trying to free up how Crawley plays in that? Is he trying to say that failures are okay, we want you to bat positively? Because, that doesn't really make sense. He's essentially saying averaging 18 is fine.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, you know, I think we might have spoken about this. Welcome back, by the way. We might have spoken about this on last week's pod. And, you know, my deciphering of the support then was that, you know, you're trying your very best to give the guy as much confidence, as much backing as you possibly can, so that he can, you know, fulfill the potential that undoubtedly he has. This is slightly different. This is saying, we're expecting you to fail a lot. I'm not entirely sure, that's a great way to go about picking your top order. It sounds ridiculous. And as much as I enjoy sort of Brendan and Ben's sort of positivity and stuff, that's just a bit of silliness. And like I said on the TV, I'm not having a go at Zach here now, because it's been patently obvious to me for quite some time that every time the kid walks off the park now, having failed again, that the light in the eyes grows a little bit dimmer and the body language becomes a little bit more sort of desperate. And it felt like the final straw for me at Lords, which is why I said what I said in the way that I said it. You know, I know as a former player and somebody whose life was and my entire sort of psyche, my entire mentality was built around whether or not I was successful in scoring runs, right? And that's one of the dangerous things about playing the game of cricket, and why people find themselves in the lowest of the lows sometimes, is because your self-worth is very much tied up in how successful you are in scoring runs, in hitting a little red ball around for periods of time which allow you to put runs on the ball, right? Which sounds really, really daft, but it is daft. You know, the whole sport's daft. And the more and more you fail, the worse that gets. you know, looking at yourself in the mirror in the morning becomes a bit of an ordeal. Everywhere he goes now with people that know anything about cricket, they're going to be giving him stick. He's getting abuse from club players. He's getting abuse from people who can't lace his boots as a player. He's getting abuse from people who really don't care too much, but kind of like figure that it's fantastic. You know, it's just somebody else to have a pop at on online or whatever it might be. And that's no place for a young man who is literally just starting out his international career to be. And there is absolutely no reason for him to be in that position at all. You know, there is noted, tick, huge promise, huge potential. Okay, brilliant. Go away, self-sorted out. Go and work out how to score runs on a regular basis, because let's face it, he hasn't done that in county cricket, let alone at international level. And when the time is right, you will come again. And you'll come again as a much, much better player. And you might add that that holy grail of consistency to the undoubted skill that you have as a ball striker. And I don't understand what's wrong with that. That's not conceding or admitting defeat or saying that your philosophy of the way to play is wrong. That's just going, this guy needs something that he is unable to get in the spotlight of Test match cricket right now. We'll allow him to go and find it, and then we will bring him back. And if you believe in him as much as you do, then there is no problem whatsoever in giving him that break. I mean, you know, and at a more basic level, what does it say to all the lads out there in county cricket trying to churn out runs, trying to play aggressively and being, managing to get their averages up around 40, or these top order players that are working unbelievably hard? It basically says to them, well, it doesn't actually matter what you do, because failure is now built in. Long-term failure, extended failure is now built into the way that we select a side. And that can't be right. Like I said, duty of care. There's a duty of care in all sorts of walks of life, in the manner in which you treat your employees. And at the moment, they're doing him more harm than good by backing him, I think.
You obviously had a really successful England career, but you had a difficult start. Just on a human level, what's it like struggling in a position so public as the England Test side, with so many eyes on you and so many people very willing to give their opinion on you after every single inning?
It's horrible, actually. I mean, you know, I remember sort of going back. So I played, I think I might have been dropped two or three times in the course of my first 25, 26, 27 test matches. And, you know, I made a couple of hundreds and I made a lot of low scores. You know, I had no proper concept of how I was going to be sort of have sort of real longevity up there. And every time I went back to play for Surrey in between, you know, the supporters of whatever club we were playing, it was particularly Glamorgan, actually. It's one always sticks out, because they'd always sing songs about how much better Steve James was than me, you know, all this kind of stuff. And, you know, that's basically what you get. And as I said, you know, mentally that chips and eats away at you. And of course, you know, I went away and was very, very lucky to get back inside. You know, no one was saying about me after the South Africa series of away from home in 1999-2000, oh, well, you know, this is a bloke that we're going to be hanging our hat on for the next 10 years at the top of the order. You know, I didn't have that. That wasn't the case. I didn't have that sort of backing. Go away and work on your game, and you'll come back and you'll be our, you know, you'll be the guy. I literally went away and didn't think I'd ever play again. But funnily enough, you work hard and make some changes, make some adjustments, and suddenly the chance presents itself, and you're better. You're a better player, and you cope with it better. Now, I think, you know, 24, 25 the first time round in the similar amount of test matches, and average 40 for the rest of my career, batting at three. So it's not, it really isn't the end of the world to be left out. And I'm slightly surprised that the management are sort of putting him through this in order. It almost seems like they're doing it in order to justify themselves rather than doing what's right for him. Mm-hmm. So look, you know, I've said my piece. There's nothing going to change my mind that says that continually pushing the guy out of the door is going to do him any favors long term. What's going to do him favors long term is to go away, have a really, really good think about the art of making runs, work out a way that gives his undoubted ball striking ability a chance to show itself, i.e. by doing the old fashioned things well of of being good, being playing the ball late, knowing what to leave, putting the bowlers on, you know, giving the bowlers the, you know, the option to kind of come after him a little bit. Because at the moment, they don't even have to do anything. They just have to sit in there and wait, and he'll make a mistake. Make them have to chase you a little bit, and then eventually, you know, when was the last time you saw Zach Crawley play a pull shot? He's fantastic on the pull. They don't, but they don't, why are they bowl short at him? There's no point. You just pitch it up, and he'll nick it eventually. So you have to be able to play in a way that then forces the bowlers into coming to your strengths a little bit. And at the moment, he can't do that.
And finally, a question away from the Test match on the 100. You've worked on the 100 in its first 2 years. Are you getting tired of the discourse around it? It's been a long time since the competition was first announced, and now it's been a while since the competition actually started. You called someone out on Twitter, who called you out for calling an over a set during a Test match, something that's been done since the beginning of time. Is it becoming increasingly grating having to deal with those types of comments?
Look, I tell you what, I have an enormous amount of sympathy for the traditional cricket fan. Not only are they unable to, well, they are able to watch their counties, but you know what I mean, during the 100. But let's not forget, you go right back to the very beginning of this and the horrendous marketing around this new competition, which basically said, we don't want you. You're surplus to requirements. This tournament is not for you. We're going to steal all your best players, and you're just going to have to lump it. And that was the basic marketing shout at the beginning. So if those were the messages that you were putting out, then you cannot be surprised, upset, or angry when people react badly to that and continue to kind of be indignant about the entire shebang. Right. So that's so first and foremost, there's my position. However, it comes down to looking for every tiny little thing you possibly can to start yelling at, calling people out, giving people a hard time for things that are literally just, you know, just normal cricket terminology, normal things that happen on any given day in any game of cricket, whether it be club cricket. I think I said in the tweet that it because I didn't want to speak for people that I didn't know well enough, right? So I said in my tweet, I think it was I must have said something without even considering it, because it's just such a normal thing to say in the professional game. Terrific set of six from Jack Leach, and then said whatever the score was. And so then then stupidly I dived in, and I very rarely do this, but I did on this occasion, thinking that all I had to do was just say, look, it's just something that there's something that we've been saying for years, for 30 years I've been in the pro game, long before the 100 came along. And some people took an exception to my using the word the pro game. So lots of people coming back to me who weren't pro said they'd never heard of it before. I said, well, that's probably because you weren't a pro, right? And then I had lots of people in the club game coming back to me saying, we say that too, you know, in support of me. And the whole thing became an absolute shit show. People sort of like talking about how much they love the game, and as a, you know, and because they love it, then I can't love it either because I've used a particular word and a particular term. It's nonsense, and people need to stop. There are many, many good things about what the 100 is doing. In terms of bringing in a new audience, all of those things that they said that it would do have turned out to be true so far. Is it a panacea? Is it going to solve the game's issues going forward? Very much the jury is out on that, simply because it causes so many problems elsewhere. For that, you know, we're talking about replacing Zach Crawley. Well, who do you replace him with? You know, no one's played a Red Bull game for goodness knows how long, et cetera, et cetera. You know, members being upset about the lack of cricket to go and watch in August. All of those things stand. But come on, everybody grow up a little bit. The chances are that things will change again, because everybody accepts, even the most vociferous supporters of the 100 and everything that it stands for, everybody accepts that there are issues and that they need to be sorted out for the good of the whole game. For the good of everything and everybody. Peace, man.
Well, cheers for your time, Butch. And happy birthday for tomorrow. Is that right?
Yeah, 50. 50. Jeez.
Well, enjoy it.
Thanks, man.
Joe, so much of the chat after each of England's five tests this summer, positively and negatively, has been about this new style of cricket. But at the end of the day, this is a team with three guys averaging less than 27 in the top seven. Results like this are just going to happen regardless of the brand of cricket with that personnel.
That's absolutely the case, undeniable. And crucially, whatever brand of cricket you play, whatever your philosophy, with this England side, when Joe Root doesn't score runs, they lose. And that obviously happened at Lord's and against a really, really good South African attack. England can't be so reliant on him because he is going to get good balls and he is going to be dismissed. And I don't think Bazball was in any way to blame, really, for what we saw at Lord's. I thought England were poor. I mean, the Alex Lees shot really set the tone and they didn't get much better from there, really. Ollie Pope, the one shining light. The little brief spell of wickets before they let it go on day two. But there wasn't really much to shout about there. The thing that kind of concerned me a little bit afterwards was when McCullum said, we need to look at it. I'm not sure we went hard enough because, I don't know, watching that South African attack, I didn't feel like there were any loose deliveries that England could have seized upon. And there's a real difference between what we've seen with this South Africa attack and we've seen with India and New Zealand early this summer. Against New Zealand, England went hard against Southie. When Matt Henry came to the side, they went hard against him. Ajaz Patel, whenever he bowled, they went. And then even with India, Bumrah and Shami were fantastic. But then the drop-off to Siraj and Thakur, who are both quite out of sorts, was dramatic. And England went hard at those guys and then got such momentum they could actually go against the kind of the premier bowlers as well. South Africa's attack doesn't really let you do that, particularly when Jansen and Ngidi, who are, you know, the weaker links in theory, are bowling as well as they did and don't have to bowl that many overs because they've got so many options. So at this stage, it's looking like a hard series for England to win at this point. We know they can do it, but I certainly wouldn't be putting much money on them to bounce back and win 2-1 at this stage.
It's interesting as well, Taha last week picked out like the pace of Stafford's bowlers as like how England went against them as sort of the key defining factor, which looks like a good prediction based on the first test. But that also, in a couple of ways, that kind of nullifies being ultra aggressive, because firstly, it is just harder to assert yourself and to like, I think you can pick and choose less which balls you can hit when someone is bowling at 90 miles an hour, but also it means that you will score quickly kind of regardless. You don't need to be putting the tempo back onto South Africa, because if you do stay in for any amount of time, you will be scoring at a decent rate. I mean, Rabada has this brilliant strike rate because like 3.5 runs and over through his career because they are so attacking. So actually, it's almost quite hard to put pressure back onto bowlers who are going to go for runs anyway, and that's kind of already their game plan, if you know what I mean.
Just on South Africa, it's been an amazing turnaround for them. When they lost against England at home 2.5 years ago, it felt like they were at a really low ebb. It's unlikely, but it's possible that they go to number one in the world by the end of this year. They're top of the World Test Championship already. The South African journalist Dan Gallen tweeted that there's more than one way to be bold in Test cricket, and South Africa putting Jansen at six, when I think you guys on the show said last week it's probably a push for him to be a seven. That paid off big time. And that bowling attack is so good, isn't it? South Africa recently beat India in South Africa. No one really expected that. But with those four bowlers and Maharaj as well, who's a very, very serviceable left-arm spinner, they're going to challenge pretty much anyone in the world, wherever.
Yeah, bowling attacks win test matches in the end. And Joe's right. Suddenly, it's one hell of a mountain for England to climb, to claw their way back into this series. In the top 10 all-time strike rates in the history of the game, George Lohmann, remember him? He's top. And then across the next nine spaces, three of them are populated by South African players, bowlers who played this week at Lord's or last week at Lord's. So that's the level that they're working at. And the fact that it's a strike rate table as well is telling, because that notion of South Africa playing grizzled attritional cricket, sitting in, bowling dry, is not borne out by the stats. They have some champion seamers and they utilise them brilliantly. And it was very striking watching it on day one, but in particular on day three, how England didn't really have anywhere to go because they were just relentlessly coming at you. There was that brief period where Norkia, who's unreasonably fast and terrifyingly fast, lost his way briefly And Bairstow played a few shots, and I think he took him for 15 or 20 off his first couple of overs. But after that, that was the only period in the game across 83 overs, by the way. England batted for 83 overs across the whole of the game. You've got to go well back into the annals, right, Ben, apparently, to find an equivalent.
So it's England's shortest home defeat in terms of the total length of the Test match since the 1800s.
Right.
And the fewest balls they faced in a home defeat since 95. So
yeah, it's the Edgbaston death trap against West Indies. Yeah, so that's the context. But only for that 20 minutes, even less than that, when Norkia was finding his radar on day three, did England look like they had any respite against an astonishingly varied and high-level attack, which we did know about. But one thing you can't legislate for is how a player rocks up at Lord's and performs first up. And Geedy, fresh to that situation. Jansen, again, fresh. That Jansen spell on the first morning when he got rid of Root, and it was a kind of a bail clipper on the top of the leg stump. That said, a brutal break back from left arm round. And there was no way out for England at any point. This notion, whatever you want to call it, something ball, I forget what the term is, that was irrelevant, I thought, for most of the game, really.
And that's why I was surprised to hear McCullum bring it up as kind of identifying factor of the defeat, was that they hadn't gone hard enough, because that just wasn't how I read it at all.
Yeah,
I think that would be a bit of positive kidology in his own dressing room.
Sure, sure.
Don't go into your shell. Because you've been outgunned, don't go into your shell. Yeah. Still believe in the way.
Yeah.
I suppose. Just briefly, Rabada is a champion. We know that. But I was just saying it before the show. You look for these little kernels of optimism in what's a very muddy and knotty and concerning modern landscape, with South Africa's test future being squeezed ever more, as we know. And that was the subtext across the whole of that game, and will be rightly across the next few weeks as well. It's worrying, to say the least. But and so in that context, you look for these little moments, and Rabada walking off, beaming, and then doing the honours board square with his fingers to the dressing room, and then the little squiggle, get my name up there, was a throwback to the real fundamentals of the game, and a reminder that for all the money that swirls around, for all the power that players have, and for all that priorities are shifting individually and collectively, and we should all be very mindful and nervous about that, I think. And yet, in the end, there's a sort of atavistic beauty to it. You still can't get any better than that. And you saw the way Norkia reacted at the end. He was a kid. He was just a bounding kid. Didn't know what to do with himself afterwards. And in all the interviews he gave, he was lovingly naive and childlike. And that was my abiding memory of what was, of the game. I was there for the vast majority of it, and was really taken with their story, because it's given extra poignancy, I suppose, because of the landscape that we're faced with.
Yeah, it's interesting, because I wouldn't have said, usually, I don't get too hugely patriotic about cricket, but I do want England to win, I think probably more than you do most of the time, to be fair, Phil, I think.
More than Phil says he does.
I said Spurs to win more than England, yeah. But probably England to win more than you. Yeah.
But there's not been too many times where I've wanted South Africa to beat England, and I'm not saying I want them to beat England, but I would not begrudge them in the slightest this summer. There is something about the kind of the context, the environment, as you're describing, the relatively few opportunities South Africa get, and also just the likability of their side, actually, as well, that I'd be perfectly happy with that. The one thing is, I'd like England to put up a bit more of a fight, because this could be this was a really entertaining match, but it wasn't a good match in the sense of a close match, clearly. And I was really looking forward to this series, because I thought it would be tight, and it'd be a real shame if England keep doing this and actually don't give enough of a fight as they should against what's clearly a very good side.
For what it's worth, I'm sticking to my prediction that it will be 1-1 going into the Oval, as I wrote in the magazine, and then all to play for on a result pitch at the Oval, as it has been all year. I'm still leaning that way, perhaps more in hope than expectation. It could easily, as you also wrote, Joe, in the magazine, it could be it could be a steamroller either side. Momentum in a three-match series is quite key. England do have form in flipping bad performances on their head. They do have form, and they are obviously mercurial anyway because of the extremes of the way that they want to play, at least. But again, just on that point, just briefly, what struck me on day two was how military and pedestrian the attack is, and how in some ways it's a bit of a it's a conflict with the philosophy. It's very hard to play expansive, breakout, expressive cricket when all your bowlers bowl from a similar height, right arm over, in a very, very similar MPH bracket. And you have a left arm spinner who I thought actually bowled really well, Leach, probably the best I've seen him bowl at Lord's anyway. And he stemmed the flow a little bit on day two. But still, there was a predictability to that attack. And it's very hard to know where to go. For all Folks' funkiness with his fields, and again, always interesting to watch him in the field. After that, you are hamstrung. You are hamstrung by a lack of pace and a lack of variety.
Well, Stokes is where you go to, and we can't keep going to that well because...
He fell over three times, yeah. Stokes. He clearly was in pain, wincing throughout. And you're right, he was their only point of difference. And you don't want that situation.
I think you make a valid point about the South African batting lineup. It's very, very inexperienced. And were it not for that Elgar Erwe opening stand in the second innings, it could have been a very different test match.
Also, you know, the toss important. Mm. Dreamlike Lord's first day, bowl first conditions. England's result, England's collapse was exacerbated by some pretty injudicious shots, as Joe says, you know, with Alex Lees setting the tone with a sort of flat-footed and rather absent-minded waft, and then it went from there. But even so, big toss to win that one for South Africa.
Ben, with the context of what's going on with South African Test cricket, in that basically they're not going to play three Test series anymore, is there almost a sadness to seeing them do so well, and with a player like Marco Jansen, who's 21 years old, 22 years old, doing so well so early in his Test career? I mean, we're talking about it before we start recording. South Africa got a pretty good case to be the most consistent Test side of the 21st century. You definitely associate South Africa doing really well whenever they've come here, with the exception of 2017. They've won in Australia a few times this century, more than anyone else has. Almost sad seeing a team that could be the number one side in the world according to rankings and according to the World Test Championship table, knowing that they're doing so well at the moment, possibly not playing that much Test cricket in the next 4 years.
Yeah, it's massively sad. And I mean, just to line out how stark this is in the new Future Tours programme, so Neil Manthorpe wrote a very good column, which is in the new magazine, also on wisdom.com, and he points out that every series of four or more matches in the new Future Tours programme is between two of the big three Test sides, and every series of three or more matches involves at least one of the big three Test sides. So outside of the big three, there are two match or series or one-off Test matches, which is obviously, I mean, two Test series are pretty rubbish in my opinion. I mean, you know, you get the odd good game, but they almost always feel unsatisfactory in some way. And as you say, this is a South Africa team that is brimming with potential. Manthorpe wrote in that piece that he felt this was possibly the most important series South Africa maybe ever played, and with the implication that a statement result could show that they demand more time and more games and time in the schedule from the big three. But I think that's kind of optimistic. I kind of think that economics will just end up winning out, and that South Africa will just play very few three Test series from here on out. And then when they do get to play them, when the next one is, what, in at least 5 years' time, because if that's how the schedule is allowed it, they will be a weaker Test team by that point, because they'll have had so much less game time than the rest of the teams. And one thing I was discussing it with Taha, I think, and I think it's a shame, I think, that the four-day Test movement or proposition didn't gain any significant momentum, because I think if there was a real sort of popular swell behind it, then when the first World Test Championship was launched, or when the second schedule was being decided, it would have been possible for that to be a concession, that you say we have a minimum of three Test series in the World Test Championship, but they can be four-day Tests, because you're scheduling 12 days of cricket rather than 10 days. And we know that lots of Tests, as this one did, finish within that time limit anyway. And that, to me, would be a much, much preferable state of affairs normally have at the moment when three test series outside of the big three nations basically don't exist anymore.
It feels like that the dynamic around that four-day test conversation has changed quite a bit, because when it was first brought up, it seemed like a kind of heinous suggestion to those who have followed test cricket for such a long time. Now it's actually starting to feel more like a solution that might help test cricket survive. And I do sort of detect that shift among, or Mark Taylor, you brought up the other day, Mark Taylor.
Did I mention that on the show?
Yeah.
Right.
Brilliant Australian captain. His reputation is built on test cricket, saying four-day test cricket might well be the way to go to keep this thing going.
And it's held that position for years as well, for a number of years.
Butch talks a fair bit about Crawley. Are there any changes you guys make to the England team? Maybe not immediately, but Ben Folkes didn't exude a whole lot of confidence against the pace of Norkia in particular. Harry Brooker is still waiting on the outside, one of the form players in the country, 100 in his most recent Red Bull game. Phil, you've made a noise.
Yeah, I mean, I'll go first. Ben Folkes is not a great player of ultra-quick bowling, and the stats bear that out. And by reputation, he's known to not be an outstanding player against the quicks, the real quicks. And the two shots that he played were indicative of that. You know, it's the age-old cliche that you do weird things in the face of extreme pace. And he did play two shots that he wouldn't like to revisit.
Just on that, I thought Michael Atherton did a really good explanation of what it's like facing really, really fast bowling. He said you basically get to a certain point, he said about 88 miles per hour, where you just can't actually track the ball anymore. So even against 85 miles per hour bowlers, he said, you can actually track the ball to the bat. And he said, there's an element of guessing where the ball's going at a certain pace. And some players are going to have a natural ability against that. Some players aren't. And Norkia is so fast, bowling at 94, 95 miles per hour, that is just a different game to anything you can really prepare against in the county game in particular.
Yeah, indeed. And it remains the ongoing mystery, doesn't it? That eludes, obviously, the four goons sitting around a table here. It's a level of sporting, it's inexplicable how they do it. And studies have been made. I remember Atherton was actually a part of one of these studies that was made years and years ago. And various clever people from universities concluded that you literally can't see the ball. So you are reacting to certain clues and ticks and giveaways in the hand, the position of the hand in the run-up. And you are looking at a vague area, hoping that the ball will emerge at some point as this blur, and then the muscle memory is meant to kick in. But so much of it is an anticipatory thing rather than being able to track it from the hand and then react accordingly. I mean, it's mind-blowing. It really is. Answer your question. If they have the Folkes conversation, then they have to have the Bairstow conversation, don't they? And do they dare, when Bairstow is finally at ease in his position in that team? You can imagine the lorry load of shit that will come down on their heads if they say, all right, Johnny, you know what's going to happen, mate. You've seen it coming back at 6 or 7, and here are the gloves. Remember how to catch? I don't know.
You can't put him down at 7.
Well, I suppose one workaround would be, unless you think the workload would be too high.
What, keep him at 5 and give him the gloves?
Yeah, and put Stokes at 7. I mean, Stokes is effectively batting like a number 7 at the moment. I mean, his returns are better than people, I think, assume at 7. He's still averaging just under 40. But he isn't batting with someone who's going to have any sort of permanence. He is coming out looking to change momentum of a game. That suits the role of number 7 more than it does someone in the top 6. No, it's just one position. But and then you bring in Harry Brooker, number 6, possibly. I mean, it might be that that's getting a bit too funky, and that it is the actual having of the gloves that...
It's a very interesting solution to this question, which I don't think is a question they'll be considering yet, by the way. You know, it's Folkes' time. He's done okay since coming to the side. His keeping's not been foolproof, but then no one's is ever in history. Alan not dropped catches. They're not ready yet to begin having that conversation. That said, if we are having it, then that is a good theory. But then, of course, you lose the magic of Stokes at 6, where that 5.5-6 position that he's been in for the last 3 or 4 years, and he's obviously been, you know, superb in that position overall. That would be what you'd lose. But it makes sense, right?
Yeah, it does make some sense. I think it'd be a shame, because I think Stokes would continue to play in the way that he is, and I don't want him to play like that. I want him to play like a proper batter. You're kind of giving him more license when he's taking about all the license he could anyway.
Good point.
I'm
really keen to get Harry Brook in, but I think you stick as you are for the time being. I saw Alistair Cook suggesting Harry Brook open in place of Crawley. I know we're not allowed to mention Crawley, but it's difficult when we're mentioning the team selection. That's an option. Doesn't feel like a particularly great option. Or
Cook acknowledges that himself, I think. Yeah, he says, if you do drop Crawley, I guess you'd have to go Brook.
If we're looking for an opener, I'd still go back to Rory Burns. And I'm sure there'll be groans from people listening to this podcast, but he's got 100 against a very good Australian pace attack in these conditions. I think he averages 34 in England, which, you know, is not well beating, but it's pretty good as English openers goes these days. It's another part of the thing that frustrates me with sort of the Crawley conversation is this idea that the way that McCullum is talking it is though there is no one else out there. And I think that's a problem for who you bring in. It's one thing about giving the player in the side confidence, but if he's saying, well, he won't be consistent, he's not that good. Well, what does it say that he thinks about the guys on the outside looking in? And I think that's not a great place to start with some of these guys. And I still think, you know, Burns is a serviceable enough opener, particularly given the demands of this South African attack.
Can I say one thing on Fokes quickly? I acknowledge what you say about the Otch pacing. I think it's absolutely accurate. I'd say that you're unlikely to find many wicketkeeper batters around the world, really, who aren't going to have a chink in their armour somewhere, who are going to have a weakness. I realise it's more pronounced. But also, given the number of bowlers who are at the speed of Norkia in the world, mm-hmm. it's not the worst one to have. I guess mm-hmm. I'd also say that, I mean, as you rightly say, he won't have faced that much of it in county cricket, and therefore in his career, there's the possibility that he gets better at it as well as he faces more of it. And also, I mean, you know, this is, you could argue that, is he ever going to get a long innings considering how vulnerable he looked? But these were both early dismissals as well as they were sort of technically culpable ones. And, you know, you do get your iron, don't you? So it might be that after he faces 30 balls and then he is able to play them a little bit better possibly. And then also when you look at the summer, his average is really bad. He's averaging 22.6 for the summer, I think. But then when you actually break it down, the first test of the summer, he played actually a very good knock. And I think at the time you'd have said that was worth more than the 30 odd it was. And so when you look at that average, you probably take it up a few notches in your mind because of that. The second test, he makes a half century as England are trying to match that 500 and then seals the chase. And then he makes, I think, a duck in the test when he has COVID, misses a game. And then this has been his first full poor test match. So although the average is bad, when you break it down like that, it's before this test, I don't think people would have had that many concerns about him. And I appreciate why the concerns are there. I'm not saying, you know, not fully defending folks at all. But I also wouldn't write him off either, even if that pace weakness doesn't get resolved. I think that you can be a useful number seven in a test side, even if you have a vulnerability, I suppose.
Yeah, it doesn't feel that long ago that we were sitting around this table talking about Ben Folkes looking really impressive at that in that number seven role. So I think be wary of flip-flopping. Stick with him for now.
I think we've done well not to mention Josh Butler's name there. Anything you change the bowling attack?
Ollie Robinson for Stuart Broad, and I think I'd have done it for the first test as well. Essentially because at this point in time, Ollie Robinson is a better test bowler than Stuart Broad, or at least from the look of how he bowled in that that warm-up game, went on a flat pitch. He caused Africa real problems in that second innings. And just going back to last year when Robinson was brilliant throughout the year. I know Broad missed some of it through injury, but Robinson he was ahead of Broad in the pecking order at that point, and now has been struggling with fitness and injury and has now slipped behind him again. And the question I can't work out is why exactly. If England have concerns about his fitness and his ability to get through a test match, then he shouldn't be in the squad, I think, because he might have to play. You know, someone rolls an ankle, Robinson will be the next guy they call to come in. So I think Robinson is, I think, a better bowler than Stuart Broad right now, and therefore he should play. I mean, he doesn't, you know, solve the problem of the high pace and everything, but I think that he will cause South Africa problems.
They will be worried, England, because they were comprehensively out-bowled, and not just through the air in terms of pace, but they were very innocuous for the first couple of hours against South Africa's openers. I think there was one half chance where Elgar nicked one through third slip gully. But aside from that, it was very manageable. Potts was eager, bowled some good balls, but was also quite ineffective in many cases, and went for a few. I think it was like 10 overs for 50 odd at one point. Broad was innocuous as well with the new ball. Anderson was Anderson, of course. But they didn't really have that anywhere to go quite quickly, and it was quite evident, I thought. And what the impression I got of what Stuart Broad did was instinctively reverted back to the previous iteration of Stuart Broad, when his figures seemed to be running away from him a little bit. He pulled his length back, and he went safe. It felt to me, anyway.
That's what Philander on TMS was saying as well. He was quite critical of.
Right. Okay.
He's very measured, but he clearly didn't think that Anderson really, and Broad bowled very well. That they're both a bit defensive, playing it a bit safe,
It felt like that to me. Broad was hit down the ground early on by Elgar, punched him through mid on, and then another one on his pads, and he hit him through mid wicket. So those two over pitched deliveries, and you can kind of understand where Broad's coming from, because it looks floaty. And so then he pulls it back, but then you lose the impact of the new ball. And when you're defending 160...
But that's also a reason to be more cautious as well, isn't it? You can go,
sure,
it can go both
it's
ways.
It's the balance. Yeah. It is, you're right, of course it is. It's the balance. But I felt like they neglected that chance, and that Broad decided, maybe even subconsciously, just to hang back. And suddenly they're 50 for naught, and then the game is inching away from you.
Joe, you spoke to Ben Stokes last week. What was that like?
It was good. Yeah, it's one of those kind of sort of press junket things. So you get a very clearly marked 10 minutes and you can only ask him about the film. So, you know, it was more one-dimensional than it would be if I was just going to ask him about anything I liked. But he was good. The film's good. The film is enjoyable. I guess as pure cricket fans, if you're listening to this podcast, you probably are. There's quite a lot of stuff that you'll know that they obviously have to feed the wider Amazon audience. But there is some genuine insight in there, and in particular the interviews he's doing with Sam Mendes, which are just 2 weeks after the panic attack that he has in Nottingham. It's interesting that he's still kind of living that whilst he's being interviewed. And to be honest, he looks like he does not want to be there at all. And I kind of addressed that in the interview. It must have been a really tough thing to go through. Even aside from the difficulties of experiences, to then have to kind of face up to the cameras and be interviewed by a Hollywood film director. And then the scenes in New Zealand are really moving when he's out with his dad shortly before he dies, as he's kind of dealing with this illness, this, you know, incredibly strong man who is, you know, is fading fast, and seeing his son go out there. It's really moving stuff. And again, I was like, that would be a difficult thing to have a camera in the background while you're going all through this. And I thought Stokes addressed those questions pretty well when I put them to him.
Well, here is Joe's chat with Ben Stokes.
Ben, with documentaries of this kind, you generally have the subject of the film reflecting on an experience after the event, but this film's a bit different in that Sam Mendes is interviewing you when you're really still at a low point, just a fortnight after you've had that panic attack and reached out for help. How difficult was it to be interviewed at that point and kind of to explain what you were going through when you were still clearly right in the heart of it?
No, honestly, not at all. You know, I wanted it to be in there. You know, so it was very important that sort of I sort of said I wanted to do it. Take you back to the before we even started filming, like one thing that I said I really wanted to do if we were to do this was to make sure that this whole thing was authentic and it was me and it wasn't a PR stunt to make me look good, if that makes sense. You know, like been through, you know, loads on the field, off the field, that, you know, I don't want it to just be good, 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 you know, because there's been a lot of bad as well. And I think if we didn't include stuff like that, people who watched it would be like, why is that not in there? Like, why is it all just good stuff? Because, you know, I've seen it as an opportunity to actually put myself across as actually me, not what maybe people think I am, because what they see in the field and what they see in, you know, press conferences or whatever it is, you know, like, just wanted to be authentic. And, you know, Sam and the Whisper team, I think, were very happy when I was of that opinion, that I wanted it to make sure that this is completely me and it's not like scripted or can you do this, can you be like that here, because I don't think I would have enjoyed it. I don't think the product would have been as good. So everything in the documentary is me in its purest form.
Throughout your career, you've never given the impression of someone who is especially motivated by the idea of fame or celebrity, or seemed to find it especially appealing. I wondered if you had any reservations about opening your life up to the public through this film and potentially reaching a new audience outside of cricket that wouldn't necessarily have followed your life otherwise.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think when I watched this back for the first time. I've only watched the first cut, by the way. I haven't managed, not lucky enough like you, to be able to see the final version, because I wanted it to be a surprise for me as well when I watched it for the premiere. But what this, I feel, watching it for me was, it was as great as it was also a very strange and surreal thing to watch something completely about me, but watching it of someone who I didn't know. It's really hard to explain, because even though I knew what was in there, I knew what was going to be coming up, I knew the situations and I knew the scenarios that were on screen in front of me, I was watching it like, geez, I don't know what's going to happen here. And there's quite a lot of things in there as well that, you know, is a lot of people will have no idea. You know, that's not just people who don't know me, but I think that will be family members, that will be friends who don't really understand the full impact of what certain situations, how they affected me, how they affected my family, how they affected my friends, you know, my personal life. And especially with the mental health stuff, like, I was very proud of how open and honest I was with that particular period. Because I know that it might help someone deal with something, or it might help them come out and make them understand that, you know what, I'm actually not feeling good, and if I can come and do that on a, you know, universal stage like this documentary is gonna put it to, then that's huge for me, knowing that, you know, them watching this and seeing that particular bit might actually help them and make them realize that it's not weak, it's not a sign of weakness to show that, you know, you are feeling a bit shit sometimes.
Yeah. I thought the scenes with your dad in New Zealand were kind of the most intimate and moving of the film. Did it feel strange having cameras around for what would normally be such private moments? And have you had a chance to watch that bit back?
Yeah, honestly, like, no, it didn't. Like, no. Because what the Whisper guys were amazing at doing is not making it feel like a scripted scene, because they were just there, but they were just so in the background and you forgot that they were around. A great example is when they came out to film in the West Indies for that tour, is that, you know, we obviously had to address the group saying, like, you know, this documentary's happening, there's going to be a film crew around following Ben, you know, you might see them in and around, but, you know, they're going to try and not get in the way. And they were very conscious of that they might do that, they might interfere or get in the way. And then when they'd finished filming and I'd sort of, you know, said thanks to the lads for just sort of cracking on, they were like, oh, how long were they here for? Like, I thought they were here for like 3 days. So, like, that's how good they were at staying away and making every filming bit that they were doing just like not set up, and they're just there, like in the background, like you just forgot they were there. And I think that comes across really well in the doc, that it's just, yeah, you just see me as me.
And at one point you say in the film that you used to fear failure, but now you embrace it. I wondered, was there a particular moment where that changed for you, and has that changed of perspective influence the first few months of your captaincy, what we've seen over the last few months?
No, just for a while now, like, yeah, because I look at it going, if I didn't have nerves, if I didn't worry about me personally failing, then I think that shows that I don't care. You know, like, if I don't have nerves about a situation, I'm like, oh, well, I'm not that bothered how it goes. If I don't have fear of failing, because if I don't do well, then, you know, the team's gonna, I don't know, someone else needs to, like, do well for us to do well. So if I don't have those feelings towards cricket and my sport and my job, then I sort of look at it as, well, I don't really care. So rather than, like, letting all those emotions of fear and failure eat me up and swallow me, I just embrace it and go, you know what, I'm glad I feel like this, because it shows I really care.
Stuart Broad says at one point that he genuinely thought you might never play again when you took your break from the game, and he was catching up with you, but he said he wasn't talking about cricket, he was just talking about kind of life in general. Do you think that was ever a realistic possibility, that you could have just said thanks very much and walked away from it all?
Oh yeah, definitely. Like, and funny you say that, one of the standout things for me watching it back for the first time, the documentary, was actually hearing one of my friends say what I was thinking without me actually saying that to anybody. I never mentioned it to anybody outside of my circle. But the fact that I was giving off those vibes to someone without telling them, that to me was like, Jesus Christ, that was like bad there. Like, yeah. Like I at some stage I was happy. Like I was just like, I might not play again here. I will just see how we go. Like, but then to see Brody come out and like really seriously say, like, I could see him not playing again. For me, that was like a, oh shit. Like really powerful scene for me, that one.
Yeah. You said you were really keen for it to be authentic, but you know, you were going through a tough time at that point. Was there any part of you that just wanted to be left alone and to deal with this stuff in your own time? Or do you think actually having, there's a bit, some of the stuff with Sam Mendes almost comes across as like a therapy session in itself. I wondered if it kind of possibly helped in a way too.
Look, talking helps with that kind of stuff. But like, yeah, there was times where I was just like, you know, just with certain things. But I guess it's so hard to actually explain to someone how you feel at a time like that. But I guess great way to explain it is that at the time I felt a real responsibility to make sure that I get on camera and speak about this.
And just finally, there's a really nice moment with Joe Root when he says that not many people get to see the best side of you, but he's very grateful that he does. You haven't seen the final product, but do you think this film will help in that regard, and people will see, if not necessarily the best side of you, a more authentic version than we might have perhaps pieced together from the press?
Well, I hope so, because that was the aim of it, is to come across as me and no one else but me, away from what people might already have a opinion of what I'm like, you know, but that opinion's probably only formed from what they see of me when I play cricket or anything like that. Obviously, my friends and my family and people who are close to me know what I'm like, but, you know, there's quite a lot of people around the world who know who I am but don't know me for what I am, if that makes sense. Yeah. But look, you know, some people will watch it and might think, oh, he's a legend, but some people might watch it and think, oh, he's an absolute prick, but that's for their opinion. And yeah, they're allowed to think like that.
The Cricket Supporters Association has launched its biggest survey yet and is looking to find out what cricket fans think about a wide range of issues and topics surrounding the game, with questions relevant to players and non-players, and including questions on scheduling, cricket formats and engagement, county membership, diversity and inclusion. The survey also includes questions relevant to the current ECB High Performance Review to give supporters the opportunity to have their views heard. The way this will work is that all insight and statistics gathered from fans who take the survey will be analysed anonymously by the CSA and presented to the ECB to enable fans' views to be considered in relation to the review. The ECB will then continue to work with the CSA as the review continues to obtain any further supporter insight. The survey also asks about discriminatory behaviour and what has or hasn't been seen or heard at cricket by fans of the game and any related impact this has had. This will assist in the current work being undertaken within the game to tackle racism and promote inclusion and diversity. To take part, all you have to do is head to cricketsupporters.com/survey. I mean, we talk about a lot of the things that the survey covers. So if you get this far into most of our episodes, I strongly, strongly recommend you get involved and head to that link that we'll leave in the description for this episode.
Yeah, hear, hear. Never a more important time.
Joe, what's your moment of the week?
My moment of the week was last night, Sunday night, the 100, the Northern Superchargers versus Manchester Originals. Have they got a name for that derby yet? I won't call it a Roses Clash.
You're definitely not allowed to do that.
Yeah, absolute run fest. So the women's game was a record chase from the Northern Superchargers. Laura Volfart scoring 90 not out to see them home.
Did she open?
Yeah.
Finally.
Chasing.
Four or five. That
was such a good game. Deandra Dawson was hitting it so far. She was hitting the ball so far. I think she hit 68 off 30 or something.
And I think 44 off her last 10 balls.
Really?
Absolutely absurd. Yeah.
So yeah, it was a really good deck for short form cricket. And then that continued into the men's game. Manchester Originals made 208 for five, the highest ever score in the 100, men's 100. 16 sixes in there, which is another record, and eventually won by 23 runs. But actually, it looked like for a good deal of Superchargers chase, it looked like there was a good game on then. But it was the match hero, as they call him now, that I wanted to focus on. Phil Salt hit 55 from 25 as an opener. Including three consecutive sixes off Adil Rashid, really piling the pressure on Jason Roy now, who's still struggling. Got a few the other day, but it looked like hard work. So only Milan scored more runs than Salt in the competition this year. You know, Salt's played 4 T20s for England, but he's batted 6, 7, and 4. He's so clearly at his best opening up, going hard in the power play. It's only a matter of time before England have a look at him. We've obviously seen what he can do in the 50-over stuff when he got his chance in the sort of replacement squad last summer, and then against the Dutch on that mini tour there as well.
Also, whisper it, been keeping in the 4-day stuff for Lancashire. Throwing back to our earlier conversation.
Mm.
We don't know how he is against 94 mile an hour fast bowling, do we?
No, we do not. No, we do not. But stranger things have happened.
One of the things I kind of had against Salt being, I guess, the next man in for England white ball cricket is that he's got a fairly poor record in T20 competitions outside of the Blast, including the 100. So I think for him to have a really good 100 just as his name is being mentioned more in those selection meetings, I think that the timing of that is
well-timed.
Yeah, especially with the World Cup.
So I spoke to him last summer just before the 100 and had a brilliant Blast, and it felt, and he'd just played for England in the one day as... And it felt that was kind of his time. That had a poor tournament, actually. And, you know, the way he plays, he is going to be a streaky player to some extent. But there's certainly plenty to excite England fans there. I think he'll be in the squad. It's just whether he gets the nod to open or not. And just a word on the originals as well, who are my tips to win it. Lost their first 3, have won their next 3. So they're still in the hunt for the top 3. I think if they can win their final 2 group games, they've got a decent chance. And if they do that, then no one's going to want to play them in the knockout stages. They've still got a very good side. I'm not quite sure how they lost their first 3 games, to be honest. I think it was their bowlers kind of let them down a bit. Joss Butler has got a calf strain, I think it is. So he might be back for these remaining games. So obviously that's another decent player to bring in. Although Andre Russell has gone home now. That was his last game. But they've got plenty of options.
Tristan Stubbs is seeing them well.
Oh, what a player. Yeah, I was going to mention him, actually. Talking about South African cricket and the talent available. He is a serious player with a good first-class record as well. Hasn't played many games. But there's a kind of simplicity to his game, which you think maybe he could just do it. He'd do the lot if South Africa is still playing Test cricket in 5 years' time.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that game as well. I know Rashid got hit for 3 sixes in his opening set of 5, but then he was bowled brilliantly to the set, Russell and Stubbs later on. I think he bowled 10 balls in a row, and Russell basically decided, I'm not going to hit you. And then the last ball of Rashid's spell, Russell does go for the big shot and gets caught on the boundary. How have you guys found watching the men's 100 in particular this summer? I probably enjoy watching 100 games more than England bilateral games. I think there's more going on there. The overseas element, having elite overseas players alongside English players who haven't had opportunities to play against these kind of established names before, I think great to watch. Maybe that's a novelty factor that will wear off a few years in when you kind of know how these players will do against the elite, but I'm enjoying it.
I can't really compare it to... You're talking about 20 T20Is, right?
Yeah. I'm not comparing it to test matches.
Yeah, I mean, I'll watch one if I have to, of a T20I. So that's my position on those, really.
Enjoy a World Cup, though?
No, sorry. Outside of a World Tournament, where obviously the narrative is different. I haven't seen a massive amount of it, but I have to say what I have seen, I've relatively enjoyed. I've watched it with open eyes, without... getting waylaid by agendas if I can help it. And what I find is that the atmosphere, either the TV cameras are very cleverly editing the sound quality and cutting out certain barren areas of the ground, which obviously is a time-honored tactic, or it's a genuine reflection of the enthusiasm within the grounds. But the vast majority of games I've seen, if you take out the first one, which was a bit of a dead game, I think maybe at Cardiff, can't remember, but anyway, that was a tricky bad game on night one. But after that, day two was at the Oval, and since then the games that I've seen, the atmosphere has been genuinely good, and there does appear to be a connection with the fans inside the ground, at least with their home team and with the competition itself. And that for me is just about enough at this point.
I think when we sat around, what, 2 years ago, maybe 3 years ago, talking about the positives and negatives of this thing, I think one of the things certainly I thought are, and this is part of the kind of wider narrative, are people going to feel connected to these teams? Is that a problem? Is no one going to care about them in the way they care about the counties? I don't see that, actually. I think from what I've seen on TV and what I've seen here at the Oval, I think the fans are connected. And actually, just taking the Oval as an example, I think the home fans are more invested in the Oval Invincibles than they are Surrey a lot of the time. If you take it compared to a blast night on a Friday, which is, you know, a lot of young men coming for a bit of a piss up. The audience is a bit different for the hundreds. I think the kids genuinely care who wins. They go and support their team. They buy some merch. And you notice it when the opposition hit a six, there's almost a kind of silence in a way that you'd expect, I don't know, like at the IPL, which isn't the case at the Blast. The Blast, everyone cheers everything. And that's good too. I'm not saying one is better or worse than the other, but that idea that new fans wouldn't feel any affiliation to these teams, I don't think has been borne out. I think that is one thing that has been a reasonably strong success.
Yeah, I'd say that the tactical stuff has actually made probably slightly more of a difference than I thought it would as well, and it increasingly so almost. Like you find yourself, like it gets to like the last set of 10 and there's a set battering with a number 8 and the set batter takes a single. You're like, oh, why should, like that actually can feel like it takes a lot more away from a team if they get stuck off strike for that amount of time.
Yeah, I agree with that, actually. I can't even remember what the game was, but there was a few nights ago, and that's telling in itself, I can't remember which one it was, or even which bloody bowler it was, but there was a particular bowler, spinner, and he was controlling the game, and so he ended up bowling 20 deliveries across 25 available deliveries, of which this bowler bowled 20. It's shocking. You have to edit this out. I can't even remember who it was. But the point does stand, right, that there is a bit more flexibility and a bit more nuance in there than I expected to be as well. Tahir. Imran Tahir.
The one thing I'd say about this tournament, though, is there has been a bit of a lack of close games. I mean, I think you have to go back to August the 13th, the 12th match of the competition, to find the last real close game in the men's competition. I mean, that's mitigated quite a lot, actually, by the women's game starting. I think the first week of the men's tournament felt like it dragged because you have, I said this last week or 2 weeks ago, but if you have one game a day and it's any of them, you get a couple of not good games in a row, then actually you've gone quite a lot of time, and especially when that's almost the only visible cricket on, you've gone quite a lot of time without anything really that notable happening almost. Mm. Whereas now with the women's games on, you're that much more likely to get a close game each day. And it does just really emphasise how actually, obviously the men's tournament has obviously been needed for the women's to give it that sort of that platform, but also the men's one wouldn't be anywhere near as good as well without the women's as well, I think.
In the women's competition, Birmingham Phoenix and Southern Brave are top at the time of recording. Bryony Smith, who's played a bit for England but not much, is having an excellent tournament with both bat and ball. My moment of the week is watching Mitchell Stanley bowl for the first time. I saw that he bowled 92 miles per hour and kind of didn't believe it.
What was your first thought, Joe, when you heard him?
I thought he was an Australian who'd done really well in the Big Bash, and yeah. I probably should have heard of.
Yeah, and it was really nice. Exactly the same.
Really nice to hear he's from Shropshire. Yeah. And bowls really fast.
Kind of plucked from the Blast. He had Josh Butler dropped at slip in one of his first, if not his first, Blast game earlier this season. And he bowled. It was very expensive yesterday, that must be said. But his first ball to Faf du Plessis genuinely rushed du Plessis. And he reminds me quite a lot of Umran Malik in his first season of the IPL. He's not as quick as Umran Malik. He's not far off, granted. In that he's got the pace, doesn't quite know how to use it at the moment, but you kind of sense that from how good his good balls are, once he does, he's going to be a real, real handful.
Yeah, and it's worth saying quite how unknown he was. Like he played 6 times for Worcestershire before the 100 this year. So I think he would have been the most unknown player in the competition, I reckon, just about.
Yeah, possibly.
Given none of us knew who he was. Yeah. So.
And he really made, in that first, I mean, he was expensive yesterday, but actually he was a big reason why Manchester Originals won on his debut. I think in his second set of 5, it was a wicket maiden. Stanley Mitchell, not Mitchell Stanley, is from the Eminem song Stan, and it's the origin of the internet word Stan or Stans, which is from Stan culture. So that's what I first thought when I heard him. I was like, have I heard that name before? And that's what it was.
Blimey. Worcestershire produced him, you know, at the risk of this sounding like, you know, a kind of 100 show, and I know how that's going to go down. Worcestershire produced him, he's come through the ranks there, but again, a low profile, you know, didn't play in England under-19s or anything like that. But Worcestershire produced him, he's been effectively loaned away for 3 weeks of his county summer. He'll be back for Worcestershire for the final stretch of the summer. Hopefully they'll throw a 4-day game or two at him, and it'd be great to see how he goes from there on in. But it's worth remembering, we may have seen him first in 100 kit, but that's not where he began, and that's probably not where he'll finish either, you know. So I think it's probably worth mentioning that. And fair play to Worcester as well, who are bringing through some good young kids in very tricky circumstances because they don't have a massive budget, as we know. So yeah, fair play to them, feather in their cap.
I have a gripe about the 100, which is probably helpful at this point to balance things up. But I genuinely thought this the other day. So if players aren't required for their 100 sides, they're not allowed to be released to their county.
Yeah,
and that has to change. So Jack Leaning was one example who's not been able to play for Kent in the One Day Cup. You know, give the county fans a something here. It's because, you know, if the same situation was England and the county, they get released all the time. I don't see a difference there.
I think Paul Farbrace is making that point, particularly with young players. So Warwickshire have Jacob Bethel and Dan Mousley with 100 franchises, but they're not playing.
That's bonkers.
And they're currently not getting the opportunity to play in the Royal London when at 18 and 21 respectively. You think that'd be a massively valuable experience for both?
Yeah, for so many reasons, for their development, but also those are the players that Warwickshire fans want to go and see when they go and watch the One Day Cup. So it's that needs to be fixed.
Yeah, it also drives a wedge between the two tournaments. It suggests that there are fewer connections binding them, and if anything, there are wedges driven between them, and that's obviously not healthy going forward, not only for the individuals but for the overall impression of the thing.
Just on the success of the women's competition this year, already in the competition, every venue that's hosted a women's game has recorded personal best attendances this year compared to anything they had last year. Moving on, James Hildreth has retired from the professional game with immediate effect. An injury has ruled him out from the rest of the season. So he retires having played over 700 matches across all formats for Somerset, 27,000 runs, 5,400s. He is Somerset's third highest run scorer in first class cricket, averaging over 40 in the format. Widely regarded as one of the best players never to have played for England, and a genuine Somerset legend. And also this week it was announced that Darren Stevens will not be at Kent next season, but he has also not announced his retirement. So at 46, he's still not done yet. He leaves Kent after 17 years at the county, and Ben, you said that he's put his name forward for the Big Bash this winter.
Yeah, as has basically everyone in the English game. I think I saw your name on there as actually, so if you get a call from the Sydney Sixers, that'll be why. But yeah, he is going for it, which is good to see, I suppose.
Ben, what was your moment of the week?
Well, it could only be Derbyshire's points deduction in the Royal London One Day Cup. We thought the Leicestershire one a few weeks ago was a bit ridiculous. This goes way beyond that. So after they had just lost a game, there was someone there whose job it is, I didn't know this job existed, was to make sure all their kit was in order and according to regulations. And one of Derbyshire's players had a bat that was within regulations, but he had put some tape around it to keep it together. And the tape meant that the bat was slightly too thick, which meant that they got 2 points deducted from them in the Royal London One Day Cup.
Sorry, they got a point deduction because one guy's bat was a couple of milligrams too heavy?
Yes. I think too thick, millimetres too thick, too wide. Yeah.
Now, it wouldn't have made any difference to Derbyshire's chances of qualifying, but that is still mind-blowing, isn't it? Cricket never fails to surpass itself.
Derbyshire's game with Yorkshire yesterday was amazing, by the way. It was 109, played 110, I think. Yorkshire won by one wicket on a spicy wicket
at Chesterfield. Yeah, Queen's Park. Apparently, yeah, it was a shocker.
If you go through the stream, there are quite a few balls either shooting quite low or really popping up.
I think four players were hit by balls that have just spat from nowhere.
Mm. Sam Connors, who recently played for England Lions, took a fifer there for Derbyshire. The Group A is extremely close. There are four teams currently joint top with 10 points. Gloucestershire have played one more game than everyone else in that group. Sussex, Middlesex and Leicestershire, the other teams, on 10 points. And in Group B, Hampshire and Lancashire are top with 12 and 11 points, respectively. One of the performances of the round was Sussex youngster Ali Orr scoring a double hundred. He's only 21, but he's building a very good record in both red ball and white ball cricket at the moment. Someone we've talked about a little bit on the show before this summer. And Phil, you want to talk a little bit about how actually there are people going to these games. It might not be on television, but county members are still properly getting behind the Royal London One Day Cup.
Yeah, we can't pretend that it's been foregrounded as it should be. We'd be kidding ourselves. But the streams are still available. And if you if you love your county and if you're interested in how they're getting on, then they, these games are still available, more widely available than they have been in previous years. They're just not on Sky. Commentaries are still available as well. I can only speak from my own experience, and I've watched two Essex games and followed the rest relatively closely, but I've watched two myself, and they were both at Chelmsford, and they were both very well attended games with good atmospheres. You get that anyway at Chelmsford; it's a small, compact ground. But it's been they've been clearly well attended and well followed games, and from a spectator, from a fan's point of view, I've been able to watch the emergence and been able to develop my own judgments on a handful of players that I've heard about coming up through the ranks and have been recommended to me by various people at the club, and now I can see them with my own eyes. And there are some interesting stories from left field, and funnily enough, the bloke that I mentioned on our podcast a few weeks ago, who I happened to play against on the Saturday afternoon, and he smashed us for 130. Well, he's now averaging 60+, batting 4 for Essex in the 50-over stuff. He may yet develop and become a very good county cricketer. He's the South African bloke with a good first-class record in South Africa. It served a positive purpose for people who love the county game in and of itself. It could be more. It should be more. The discrepancies, as Joe just highlighted, we don't want there to be this dramatic gap between one and the other. We want it to be servicing one another. We want the system, the fabric to be tighter than it is, sure. We would love a game or two to be on proper television, for sure. But all that said, I would struggle to be cynical about the stuff that I've seen, albeit I've only seen my own team, but I would struggle to be cynical about any of it.
Yeah, and similarly, I mean, Somerset always get good fans, but they got a remarkable crowd down last weekend when they were already out. They've been hopeless, to be fair. They've lost 7 from 7, but to get, I think, a few thousand down at the ground was a really good effort. And just to echo, I think the bit of cricket, apart from the Test match, I've been most invested in across the last month or so was probably that Ben Green innings for Somerset when he hit 157. I think they needed about 130 when he came in, or not when he came in, but when they lost their 8th wicket and he got them to within 9 runs, I think, before falling the last over. It was an incredible innings, and that was, the closeness of the cricket has often been very good. And as Phil said, the standard is, while it's a different sort of standard, I suppose, to county cricket normally, doesn't mean it's worse in a lot of ways because you just get different stories emerging, all that sort of thing.
In the international game, the Asia Cup starts later this week. India and Pakistan will be without Jasprit Bumrah and Shaheen Afridi, respectively, which is obviously a shame for any cricket tournament. It might, though, give an opportunity for Naseem Shah to make his T20I debut. He took a 5 for yesterday as Pakistan beat Netherlands by 9 runs in a very good, close ODI at Rotterdam. Possible blow for Pakistan's World Cup chances. Shaheen should be back in time for the tournament, but will have had very, very little cricket before it. He's already been ruled out of the 7-match T20 series that they're playing England before the World Cup.
Yeah, and we obviously know he's massively important, as we saw in the tournament last year when he was obviously absolutely sensational in that game against India. He's one of the best and most exciting bowlers to watch in the world in that format. And I think it also shows that they've brought in Mohammad Hasnain as his replacement, which obviously is an interesting story there. But, you know, he's nowhere near.
Like double, isn't it?
Exactly, yeah. So, yeah, and it was interesting seeing on sort of Pakistani cricket Twitter in the aftermath of Shaheen being ruled out, sort of every sort of possible fast bowler from the last sort of 10 years in Pakistani cricket being discussed, like could Wahab Riaz make a comeback? Mo Amir was saying, like, why is my name trending? All this sort of thing, which kind of shows that there isn't there's just a like Shaheen in the World Game.
Yeah, I mean, Mohammad Wasim's played quite a lot and he didn't play in the World Cup last year, so he'd probably the most likely to come into the 11. Unless Naseem does really well if he gets a go in the Asia Cup. India warming up for the Asia Cup by beating Zimbabwe in an ODI series, which I'm not entirely sure why is happening. And New Zealand beat West Indies 2-1 in an ODI series. It's part of the ODI World Cup Super League. Ben, that is a blow for West Indies World Cup qualification chances.
Yeah, especially because they've obviously won one game in there. The other two games, they pushed New Zealand fairly close. So, yeah, and that World Cup Super League, it's kind of like no team wants to win that 7th or 8th spot, which I suppose is why it's the 7th or 8th spot. So, yeah, I mean, it'd be one to follow over the finish. The scorecard from the third ODI, West Indies scorecard, was amazing. It was basically exactly what you'd expect West Indies ODI batting scorecard to look like. You had Shai Hope make 51 off 100, which obviously what he does. Carmez, to be fair to him, made a very good runnable 100, and then Horan hit 90 of about 50 balls. And then there were like six single figure scores. And then like someone hit a quick 20 to get them just over 300. It's just exactly what West Indies are like in ODI cricket, and was comforting to see, if nothing else.
Phil, yeah. What's your moment of the week?
Oh, my moment of the week occurred on Saturday evening in a place called Harlow in Essex. And my team, were chasing 260 in 45 overs on a good track with a fast outfield. And we needed something like 70-odd, 80-odd when I came out to bat. And I started going all right. And another lad who's, you know, 20 years younger than me and much more energetic and in form and actually plays every week and concentrates and practices, he came out and started smashing it. And we have to win this game, right? We have to win this game because we're down near the bottom and it's a proper dogfight. And if we'd won this game, we'd have gone through. We'd have been safe with two more games to go. And our lad got out, caught long off. And then we needed something like 30 from the last four. So 30 from 24 balls, and we are six or seven down. And I hit a nice shot that went for four, and then another nice shot that went for two. And then I hit a shot as clean as I possibly can against their opening bowler who'd come back, and I tried to open the face and hit it over extra cover into that gap, and I hit it as clean and as sweet as I possibly could. And this fella, who's probably 45-50, bit of a silver fox, ran round 25-30 yards around the boundary, and apparently the ball was going for six, and he kind of dived and managed to catch it in his chest, and I was out, and it was a yard apparent, because we had two lads who were actually out there at the time walking around the boundary, apparently like, you know, half a yard shy of the boundary, would have gone for six, certainly one bounce four. And then we went bang, 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 and we lost the game by 11 runs. And I felt empty and devastated and embarrassed, and we all should have done it, and none of us stood up and all of that, right? I woke up Sunday morning, first thing I thought. Woke up this morning, first thing I thought. First thing. And this is interesting to me because I am wrestling with myself as a recreational cricketer. I've been doing it for many, many, many years. The old grade cricketer line, you know, can I do one more circuit? You know, I've got myself married. I've got a house. I've got a life-ish. Do I really want to be going back to this thing? I've only played a handful of games this year due to various reasons. But the pain was so exquisite. The disappointment was so sublimely awful that it stayed with me for 48 hours, and I can't wrestle it out of me, which probably tells me in the end that I am stuck with this fucking thing. I am here forever.
I think this is heartening stuff, Phil.
And I can't shake it. I can't shake it. I thought I was out, and it draws me back in, and there's nothing I can do about it. There's nothing. I can't shake this nonsense. I would love to be sort of loftily ambivalent about the whole thing. Oh yeah, maybe I'll play next week. Maybe I won't. Doesn't matter. No. It's in me. It's in these kind of dark veins of myself, and I can't extract it, even though I'd like to. Bottom line, we've got to win next week in the classic 6-pointer relegation game, and if we don't, then we're probably going down.
So my club had a relegation 6-pointer this week. I think if we lost that, we'd probably go down. We won it by 35 runs, which means we're probably safe, and that was just such a sweet feeling at the end of the game.
What were your figures, Yaz?
Oh, thanks for asking. 7.2 overs, 5 maidens, 2 for 9. That was really good fun.
I knew the answer to that. Yeah. I thought you'd want to tell them. So
apparently, no, I did.
Apparently
I did.
He's got his outswinger back.
Yeah, just it's not
down the hatches. He's yeah, out. They sorted out those dodgy jukes. Is that the
not a particularly obvious outswinger? But my stock ball has just been moving in by quite a lot for a while, and now I can actually control one to just about move away. And I think having both balls has made quite a big difference this season. But yeah, just that feeling of winning, almost the opposite of you. The first thing I thought on Sunday morning is like, oh, that was a good win. So yeah, long live the club game.
No. To hell with the club game. long live it.
Just before we finish, as we're going to end there, but just a slight change to what we're saying about the 100. Literally 4 minutes ago, Manchester Originals announced that Josh Butler will not take any further part in the 100 due to the calf injury he picked up last Thursday. Laurie Evans will now captain the side for the remainder of the competition, so we might want to alter our predictions for the rest of the tournament with Butler out and Russell gone.
Yeah.
Hello, Joe, it's good to have an excuse why your prediction hasn't worked.
Well, I think it could still work. They've still got a good side. I'm sticking to my guns. They won last night without him. Well, they did have Russell.
I think I said at the start of the competition that I think they'd win because they had Butler, Russell, Hasaranga, none of whom are left. Anyway, that's all we have time for today's show. Cheers, Ben. Cheers, Phil. Cheers, Joe. This has been the Wisden Cricket Weekly podcast. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week. Sports Social Podcast Network.